Forever Dog.
Welcome to another episode of Best Show Bests, the greatest hits of the best show, with me, your host, Tom Sharpling. If you like what you hear, make sure you join us every Tuesday night on Twitch at 6 p.m. Pacific for a brand new episode of the Best Show featuring callers, celebrity guests, live music, and plenty of surprises. Enjoy! We get a lot of people on the show, and it's usually a guy who got a Baby Yoda tattoo, or we'll get somebody who was a background talent on an episode of How I Met Your Mother. It's usually we're pulling from the dregs for the most part on the show, but tonight. It's very rare that we get somebody who's an honest to goodness legend on the show. And tonight, I'm telling you, we got a legend on the show. If everything is correct, we have Meryl Marco on the. Are you there?
I'm here, and I just got a Baby Yoda tattoo.
Oh, you did. So you're doing double duty then? How about that?
Yeah.
Well, then I don't even know what you just went through two levels of the roof. You're just shattering all the rules tonight.
I know, and it's kind of sad because it's not the best weather out here. So I'm not really able to sport it and get the full effect at the market and so forth that I would be getting. Although you couldn't tell anyway, because everyone's got masks on. So maybe it's just as well. We'll have to wait for the vaccine.
You got to wait for the vaccine. Maybe ask if they can inject it into middle of Baby Yoda's forehead.
Yeah. Well, that would be lovely.
Are we going to look for, there's going to be a whole series of, and look, a vaccine, it's great. Everybody should go get it. You know what I'm not looking forward to is the, whenever there's going to be a thing where it's going to be like, a famous person saying like, I got the shot. And then they're all going to like do the same photo thing of them. Like, I got the shot. And it's going to be like, oh, it's Michael Chiklis getting the shot. And it's like, add Michael.
Black and white, you mean? And it's going to be all framed one after another,
yes.
Like a commercial for something sophisticated.
Yes. I'm just waiting for whatever the hashtag is, or the device is going to be like hashtag got the shot. And then it's going to be like, you'll look and it'll be just like Jim Belushi saying like, holding like his, pulling his sleeve up in a photo. And it's like hashtag got the shot.
Well, you certainly called it first. I haven't heard anyone discussing that yet, but I think you're totally right. Are we still doing sequels?
We do so many things at the same time here, but right, you can do that. We can talk about any, I want to talk to you about anything you want to talk about, but I just want to say thank you for acknowledging that I found a way to complain about the vaccine. I think that it just takes a special skill set, and I have a real special talent to find. Yeah. Thank you. And I was the first one to start moaning about something that hasn't happened yet.
I applaud that. I totally applaud that. I didn't think of any sequels. I thought of a prequel. The only prequel I could think of was Hawaii 2.0, and it would just be mostly like whenever there'd be an action shot, there'd be buffering.
Okay, so Hawaii 2.0, yeah. And it's a prequel to which one, though? Because there's the new Hawaii 5.0.
Oh.
There's one with like Scott, with like Scott Kahn.
Hawaii 5.0 would be the Hawaii 2.0, because the new Hawaii 5.0 would be 5.1, wouldn't it?
I guess it would have to be Hawaii 5.1.
Yeah.
Would be the thing. And it's one of those ones with, I think Scott Kahn is the son of James Kahn is the.
I have to admit, but I understand that they're all getting the vaccine and are going to be making one of those commercials.
Great.
One of their opening episodes when we finally get back from the quarantine.
Sure. So it'll be Scott Kahn with his sleeve pulled up, got the shot. And also, I was surprised you're not working up a Hawaii 5.0 packet. You're not getting your packet together to staff up?
Yeah, no, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah. No, I would like very much to work on that. That would be, I can't really think of a better use of my talent than that. I guess I should watch a few of them first.
Sure. Now that seems like a great way to for you to use your particular skill set would be
Yeah,
to
it really does. It does.
be sitting in a writer's room pitching out. It's just like, what if there's some counterfeit money that's
Is that what they do on that show? I thought they were surfing.
but if the cops have to do something, maybe it's just like, what if the surfboards are made of gold and that's how they're importing the drugs, or they're made of cocaine, like the
Right,
surfboards.
they're bringing the cocaine in the hollow part of the surfboard.
Yeah, that actually, if they haven't done that, I would like.
Now that I think of it, that's actually an idea that I'm sure we could sell, and I'll be writing it up.
Sure. Well, what you did also,
You credit probably.
well,
I'm
you
just
look, you
gonna say I made that up.
you take that one. That one's a gift. That one. But I'm going to say this, and watch this segue. Watch this segue. Another thing you did write up, Merrill Marco. Want to see how we did that? Is a new book called We Saw Scenery, and it's ironic because it's a new thing you wrote up, and it's an old thing you wrote up because it's you taking your childhood diaries and
Yeah. Well, I thought what would be funny, I was cleaning out my office. I don't know if you do this, but I compulsively save everything I think is funny because I think I'm going to use it at some point. If it can actually make me laugh, I respect it entirely too much, and I save it. And if it's still making me laugh after I find it again, then I continue to save it. Some of this stuff I've had 25, 30 years. Scrap of paper that makes me laugh. Anyway, so I regularly have to weed through all this stuff, and I was cleaning out my office, and I came upon these little diaries that my mother gave me, which made me laugh just because they have a lock and a key, as if anything I was saying when I was 10, 11, 12 years old was so important that, better not see the light of day. So I thought
Sure.
an amusing thing to do would be to sit down and read them and just review them like they're an early work of literature since I went on to become a writer. And I've learned a lot of stuff. Like, first of all, that I only remembered about a third or half of what I wrote. And then also, I don't know, do you keep diaries or journals or anything?
I try and then I fail, and I'll just be like, now I'm doing it. And then it's like, I don't feel like it today. And it's just like, well, there goes that for another year. See you next year.
Yeah, that's actually what I've been doing since the quarantine. I used to keep them, but when I first got them, when my mother first gave them to me, I couldn't figure out what you were supposed to do with them because, somebody gives you a blank book with all these dates on it and tells you're supposed to write something. So I wrote down everything I did. And that's why I decided to turn these things into a book, is they were almost an archaeological artifact of what it was like to be a kid in the 60s. It's just day after day, everything. And it started to make me laugh because it's totally not the kind of way. If I keep a diary now, it's mostly whining or, some kind of stress release or something. God damn it! That sort of stuff. But these were, it was all the stuff that happened to me when I was a kid. So I thought, well, that's kind of interesting to, it's a little bit like if you found the writings of an Aztec child from the 13th century who told you what it was like every day to be a member of the Aztecs, it was a little more contemporary than that.
No, it's a really amazing book. It's fascinating. It's really funny and sweet. And there's something to the innocence in it of a kid who doesn't know how things are gonna work yet.
No, and then there was also, yes, there was that, and there was a couple of things I learned. Another thing was, I don't, speaking only for myself, but perhaps this relates to you, I wouldn't have known what the arc was of my early life at all if I hadn't been looking at this. I didn't know what that story was or if it led to anything. It didn't seem to me that those details added up to anything, but it turns out, I went into writing for TV. Are you still there?
I am, yes.
Oh, so I just heard a bunch of clicking, and I thought maybe one of those things like customer service where they go, you hear clicking, and then a minute later you hear,
No, there's no, yeah. we're not hanging up on you.
Service.
I thought you were hanging up on me.
No, I was not hanging up on you. And now I've forgotten what I was saying.
So you were saying?
It became apparent to me after I reviewed all this stuff and was trying to figure out how to turn it into a book, that I was way engaged with pop culture and media. You know, I was entering every contest that was on the radio. I was phoning radio stations, and I was entering contests on television, and I was getting my letter read on the air of some kid's show about how to have the monkey that was on the show come to your birthday party. I only got runner up, but I was excited about that. And I was doing a lot of stuff with media. It's sort of like, I wasn't just watching it and consuming it. I was working in it. Kind of.
Yeah, you were. The table was being set for your career.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Is it was because you know the guy I live with. I said that to him. Were you always phoning radio stations and entering TV contests and stuff? And he said, no, I never did that. He was just playing music, and he's a musician. So
I did that all the time. I entered contests as kids. I would call WNBC, which was the station in New York that was the
as they'd say, WNBC.
Yeah, when Imus was on it, and he would but it would be like music and there was ABC and WNBC, and WNBC became WFAN, the sports station, and WABC became like a right wing garbage distribution center.
Right.
But I would call both of them, and I do remember winning a frisbee that I won a frisbee. And then
I won I entered some contest for, there was a local peanut butter brand that had a name, the peanut contest. They were the second company to have a peanut. I believe Planters was ahead of them. They didn't have a name for their peanut. So I entered like 30 times, and I won like 3 t-shirts and a copy of their commercial, which I used to play constantly. I considered it quite a prize. I was, you know, excited about getting merch.
Oh, no. The idea of like that, to me, that frisbee. And look, I don't like frisbees. I don't play with frisbees. It's not like I ever was like, hey, let's go throw that WABC frisbee around. But I got that frisbee. I was never more excited that somebody mailed me a frisbee. And it had a little logo on it. And I was just like, this is maybe the greatest day of my life.
Sadly, you couldn't wear it to school like you could if they sent you a shirt. But then nobody was wearing shirts at that point with logos on them when I was a kid. So you couldn't really. I would have looked like a fool if I wore my session school day peanut butter peanut to school. That wouldn't have been prestigious.
Yeah. Well, the thing with saving everything, I get that. And I want to say we have Meryl Marco on the show right now, and she has a new book out, and that book is called, oh, I just had it, We Saw Scenery, the early diaries of Meryl Marco.
By the way, the name of it is because I say that on a couple pages in these diaries. When I was traveling I would go on like a little trip with my parents to somewhere, like we were living in Florida at the time, so we'd go to the Everglades, and the way I would record the event was, we went to the Everglades, we saw scenery. Which I thought was the most minimal definition it was sort of the opposite of Anne Frank. It was just minimally descriptive. And I thought that was pretty funny. I don't think I've ever used the word scenery since.
Yeah. Well, you were, it's one of those things where it just feels like you're meeting the obligation of the moment and doing the bare minimum to have met the obligation and to be like, no, I covered that one.
Older, I started to try to belly up to the bar in a more important way in the diaries. And I got my big moment when I was a kid during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I thought that was my big diary moment. So I tried to make a list of all the things I would miss if I died in the Cuban Missile Crisis and so forth. I tried to really work up a a page, knowing that probably my diary might be the only thing that would be left after we were bombed by Russia in the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Sure. No, it was important that so there needed to be a document that people could refer back to generations later. to piece the whole thing back. Like, we need to reassemble society. We've got this notebook that a child wrote.
That's what I was sort of hoping for. I was hoping for some sort of grand diary moment with that. And then from that point on, I tried to, as I got older, that was another thing that made me laugh about the diaries. As I got older, I was becoming more articulate, and I was writing for an audience, but of course I had no audience. I was just alone in my room. So I was sort of broadcasting. I felt that I should add things of import to the diary, which was mostly about boys I liked and so forth. I would put at the bottom, I'd write a paragraph about this guy, Robert, who I was very in love with. And then at the bottom, I would talk about how they were having trouble integrating the schools in Alabama. Mm-hmm. You know, just or the moon when they started the satellite program. I started to try to integrate space travel into the diary.
You were running a very progressive platform in your diary.
I was. It's a touching document. And then another thing I thought was sort of interesting about it is the amount that I was obsessed with having a boyfriend. I didn't have a boyfriend till I was way older, like maybe senior year in high school or something. But I was totally obsessed with it when I was about 10, 11, 12, 13. Felt that because I didn't have a boyfriend, my life was basically over. And there was nothing that I would be able to do. I would live a life alone forever, a reject. And
sure, you play out the string. You just were fate. Your fate was determined. And
right. There was nothing to do, really, except for just sit back and accept it. And it was so dire that I thought, well, that would be a good reason to make this into a book, because kids must still be doing this, in which case at least one kid this age who's suffering this way looks at this, they will say to themselves, well, you know, she didn't do that bad. I mean, she wrote a book. So mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It will show that there is some pattern to life after you don't have a boyfriend when you're 11.
Sure. You just got to hang in there. It's all around the corner.
Yeah, and then it really gets good, you know. That love gets so easy after that. As you get older, you know, there's no complications, and it really just a smooth sailing.
No, it's all downhill after that. Now, people know you. You've written so many books, and you also have done so much legendary TV writing and so much.
I'm such a legend that people think I'm dead.
Well, maybe now they'll be like, oh, she's alive. How about that? Yeah. And, but I've been doing this during the quarantine, Meryl. One of the things I've been doing is going on YouTube, and I watch these, like, there's this one maniac on there who puts together, I mean, I say it in the nicest possible way. This guy who I guess has every episode of Late Night and does a five hour.
Or Giller, I'm not sure how you say his name, but yes, Don Z.
That's exactly that guy.
Well, if I ever need him, if I ever have to, for some reason or other, have a piece of videotape from that place, he amazes me. He says, I say things to him like, you know, it's someplace in the early 80s, there was something about cabbage that we did, and I can't remember what it was, but it was, I think we had a head of cabbage on the show, and 30 seconds later, he sends me the video.
That is unbelievable.
He's speaking. He knows where it is. He has it cataloged, and he sends it to me. He's a great asset if you need a piece of obscure information from the origins of the Letterman show.
Oh yeah. Cause you wrote on the show for how many years?
I was in and out for maybe the first six or seven years. Mm-hmm. And you worked with Mr. Breckman, did you not?
I did. Andy Breckman was, I worked on Monk with Andy for all 8 years of Monk. Yeah. So I spent a lot of time.
You know, he was actually just like Monk when he worked on the Letterman show. He was absent-minded, very obsessed with OCD and.
Really?
And solving mysteries.
Oh, that's actually. And solving mysteries. Sure.
Yeah.
The other friend, I think we have a bunch of friends in common, including our friend Megan Keister, who put us in touch for this. So thank you to Megan. She's very funny and one of my favorite comedians and people.
Yeah, she's very funny.
But
a book out that we put out 2 years ago called The Indignities of Being a Woman, where we researched how women have been getting shit on since the first day that they made civilization complex.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny. It's a funny book about that. But it's an audio book.
Well, you're both funny, so it would be funny.
It would be funny.
You're saying it like that should be a shocker that two incredibly funny people made a funny thing. When they work together,
it shouldn't be a shocker, and yet it is.
We also, Adam Resnick is a good friend of mine as well.
Adam Resnick, I never knew him too well. He was, he was kind of an intern, I think, when I knew him.
Okay.
He was an intern and hadn't advanced to any actual status, and then he went on to become king of the world.
Yes, and he is currently king of the world, and he's a benevolent leader, and we appreciate his kindness.
The smooth transition for Trump now, isn't he?
Sure, yes, he's helping with the transitions. So you were there for like 7 or so years on and off, you said. One of the things I've been watching these like super cuts of where it's like every Albert Brooks appearance on
You mean Don Jiller put it together? Yeah,
yes.
There's one of me, and I can't bring myself to look at it.
Well, one thing I've been watching, I watched probably about 47 hours of Jay Leno on the show, and it was weird and fascinating to see. He came out like he would come out in like Elvis or something for so much of the thing.
Really good Elvis. You know, here's the thing. I met Letterman and I met Jay Leno and I met a lot of these people at the Comedy Store where I was doing stand up before the Letterman show happened. Mm-hmm. And at the Comedy Store, I was like an incoming freshman and they were like the big men on campus, Dave, mm-hmm. and Jay and a couple others. And Jay was definitely the best guy at the Comedy Store. He was the funniest. He was the biggest smartass. He had just an attitude. He was sarcastic. He used to do Elvis, and he did a great Elvis because he looked sort of faintly like Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
And I just for me that made it just a huge impression on me. He's really actually very funny. He ended up trying very hard to go middle of the road when he got the Tonight Show, but he didn't used to do that at the Comedy Store when I saw him.
No, he is consistently funny on this, and it's funny to see how hard he works to be funny, and I mean that in a good way. It's not like he's sweaty and he's so in control of it, but it's just like he would just go all out. And it's just like, it seems like it would be easy to forget that that's who that guy was, a guy who would literally episode after episode would bring out an issue of TV Guide and then go through it with like elaborate jokes written for like, it just seemed like he was working for hours on what he was going to do on the show.
He did language really well. I remember jokes where he really phrased things that were almost novelistic kind of descriptions and so forth that were like memorable. I mean, yeah, he used to really have a great act.
Yeah. But this is the thing I wanted to ask is he would sometimes film things for the show like these, like he'd bring like, it's a film of me driving a dump truck over the top of a compact car. 'Cause he was always, you know, he's one of those car guys who's
that stuff at all. That stuff I'm blank on.
Like, who was paying for that? That's what I want to know. I was like, was he going out of pocket for that?
That I cannot tell you. The way we had the show organized when I was there was two very distinct departments. There was the writing department and there was the talent department, and never the twain shall meet, because we were doing so much writing when we started that show that it was a continuum of just writing and writing and writing, because every single day the show is on again and you have to write more stuff for it. So we didn't really find out that much stuff about what was going on in the talent department. They were organizing that stuff. So I don't remember any of that. Maybe I don't even know if that was taking place when I was there. Or I was just, I didn't used to watch a lot of the shows. I was always up in my office working on the next show while the one show was on, you know.
That's how it actually is, that people maybe don't know that. It's like, if you're making a show, you don't have the latitude to be nostalgic about it or to just to sit back and just admire the thing. It's like you're just on to the next one, because that's how it's got to be.
Unless you are driving home with the host and he is complaining about every element of it, and then you're and it's slightly different.
Well, sure. No, well, then you're basically,
people are not driving home with the host, and so they don't have that issue.
Yeah, so you're getting it from all angles, then, is what you're saying.
Yeah, you do. With when you're working for a boss who dwells on his own shortcomings.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you started, you were in. You came to L.A. How old were you when you came to Los Angeles?
48.
You were 48.
Okay. Wow, I'm getting really weird.
I hear that. What is that? Jason, do you know what that is? Let's see.
I'm not entirely sure. I think it's just the phone.
Okay. All right. Jason's saying you have a lousy phone, Carol.
I'm not saying that.
There has been instances where rats have eaten my phone lines, and then okay, it's difficult to talk on the phone. But
sure. Well, let's hope the rats at least ease up on the phone for the remainder of the call. So you came to L.A.
I was 25 or 26.
Okay. What were some of those first shows you were working on?
Well, the first thing I got work really quickly, which was really just nightmarishly shocking to me. I mean, I was stunned. I sort of was taking a gamble, a risk to see whether or not I could get a job, and I got hired immediately to do research for this woman who was the head writer for Mary Hartman, which was my favorite show at the time. So I was doing that, and I was like 2 weeks after I moved here, was attending meetings with Norman Lear and stuff like that. And then I got a job as a staff writer, and they were redoing Laugh-In. It wasn't the original Laugh-In; it was called the New Laugh-In. And it was truly terrible and unfunny, and I never liked the old Laugh-In.
No, Laugh-In sucks, and that's one of the things
not my sense of humor at all. It just
well, it was like vaudeville. There was like, it's like if you watch that, people like rewrite history on some of these things where they're just like, Laugh-In had its edge to it, and it's for like 30 seconds of an episode, the rest of it was like Artie Johnson on a park bench doing like
that stuff. I mean, it would appear that someone like, for me, I just always found it laugh free, and then I was suddenly writing on it, and I didn't exactly know how you wrote jokes. I knew I could write funny, but I didn't know how you wrote a joke per se. So I had it was all new writers, and Robin Williams was in the cast, by the way. That was the most distinguishing feature. It was his first job as well. I had to learn how to write a Laugh-In sketch. This guy sat and taught me, the head writer of the thing. And it was like you had to have a small idea and then break it into like 8 sections so they could keep coming back to it, another version of it. So for instance, like you show someone playing pool, and then you pull the pool cue back and it hits the ball and the ball explodes. That would be one thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then another one, he pulls the cue back and he hits the ball and he gets hit in the face with a pie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then that would be the second one. And then the third one, he pulls the cue back and he hits the ball and water comes down and hits him in the head.
Yeah. So you were basically writing, Bazooka Joe comics.
Exactly right. It didn't make any sense at all, but you know, there'd be a laugh if he got hit with a pie.
And yeah.
I've never understood why hitting anyone with a pie is supposed to be funny.
Yeah, I see that. And I'm just like, well, I would have eaten that pie.
Yeah, why would that be a thing that you would you be hitting people with? I guess I'm not sure. I don't know if there was a moment in time where people were just amazingly obsessed and interested in the idea that you could hit someone with a pie. I don't know how that happened.
Yeah. Is that just like a thing that would read from the stage? That it would just be like, when everything was in theaters, or you're doing, it's like, if you hit it with a pie, you can see it.
Yeah, I probably was vaudeville, but I don't even know where it started. In fact, when we're finished with this conversation, I'm going to Google origin of hitting with pie.
Sure. That could be your next book.
Yeah, and then probably 2 minutes into reading of the first one, I'll forget I did that, and I'll be researching something else.
Now, what was the first time you remember hearing one of your jokes get on television?
I don't think anything on the New Laugh-In ever got on. That was such a terrible show. I don't think anybody got anything on that show. As a matter of fact, that who was hired as a writer, I think the head writer was just recycling old Laugh-In. Mm-hmm. He actually even had some Sakatumi on it, which was always mysterious and continues to be mysterious. Mysterious enough that I might want to bring it back.
Sure, you bring for the newer Laugh-In.
Maybe it's time to revive Sakatumi. I don't know what it ever meant, but it might mean something even more interesting now. And that's the first time I ever... I don't know if I have that emblazoned in my memory. It might be... I wrote a bunch of pilots with Letterman before we ever got his talk shows on.
Okay.
There were other talk shows. There was one that didn't get on that was called Leave It to Dave that was truly dastardly and was influenced by one of his managers who thought it was that the guests should come down chutes or crawl down ladders to enter instead of just walk onto the set, so they would be tumbling down into pillows.
That just sounds like it would really change the whole talk show game
boring desk stuff. There is no reason for there to be a desk, but there was no reason to have those pillows in that chute either.
But the whole thing is when you see the desk and you're just like, man, there's no reason for a desk. And then you watch like a show without the desk and you're just like, I think I wish that guy was behind a desk. Like,
it really is a weird, it's a weird thing. Having worked on that show, we had many discussions about that desk to desk or not to desk. And it just became, it would be like, why resist? We'll just have to have a desk. And I'm not sure. That's another thing like pie. Why was there ever a desk? Who knows?
Yeah. I like the idea. Yeah, but I like the idea, though.
Interview maybe is what it's supposed to be. Like, he's the boss, and the guests come on, and they're doing a job interview.
Yeah, I guess it feels that way. Just like, and it's just kind of like, yeah, you got the job. The job was to promote your thing. Thank you for you're hired. I'm just picturing if, like, the sliding down the thing is all I can think of now, picturing, like, Art Donovan or one of these like old people having to go down a slide and then be like, oh, I'm hurt. Can you, like, how long would it have been before like George Gobel got hurt?
Well, that would have been a memorable show. That would be replaying that on the anniversary show year after year after year.
Yeah. Or just somebody stuck in the chute.
That would have been great. Yeah. Sorry you didn't go ahead with that. I do remember that Letterman hated that idea immediately and then made me go to his manager and tell him we weren't doing it. was something I want to black out of my memory, and I'm going to go ahead and do that right now, blacking it out. And then there was, so there was that show, and I maybe had a joke on that show. Or
okay.
And then, in fact, I know I did. And then we went on to do another one, and then we did a morning show. So, and I had a lot of material on that one. I was pretty much writing that one single-handedly with Rich Hall. So, so that would someplace in there. You know, once it started, there were so many that I don't think I was ever one.
Mm-hmm. That it's just now you're just shoveling jokes into the train engine, like to keep the train going.
Yeah, in fact, I'm laughing. I got so few jokes on what everyone did that I started doing stand-up just because I was writing them all. And I thought, well, I've got like a billion jokes here. Why don't I get up and see if any of them work?
Start doing something with them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I was told somebody who shall remain nameless to ask you about your Timothy Leary story.
Timothy Leary? No, you mean it, Ken Kesey?
Well, I guess it would be Ken Kesey. Yeah, they got it wrong. It was Megan. It was your. It was Megan.
That I went to two Ken Kesey acid tests.
Yes. So you, Ken Kesey, author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I don't actually have a story about him. I just, when I went to high school in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I went to college there too, and I was there right at the right moment where every weird thing in the counterculture stuff exploded in the 60s. And I went to everything. I mean, I really was zealous. I saw Lenny Bruce perform. I went to two Ken Kesey acid tests. I went to two Beatle concerts. I went to Altamont. I went to everything.
So you were at Altamont.
Yeah.
And well, how far back were you?
That's the other thing is I went to everything and I left everything early. Because I never really was having a good time at these things. I knew that I needed to be at them because they were important to go to.
Sure.
So I went to them and then just left early. I didn't like the smell of patchouli.
No, well, that would do it for you then. That would be the wrong place to be if you're not into the smell of patchouli. So you saw the Beatles at Candlestick Park?
I certainly did. Twice.
Well, that's exciting.
I saw him at Candlestick Park, and I saw him at the Cow Palace was the first one. And that was another thing that I put in my that's in the book that made me laugh is, you know, you've often heard of people who said they went to Beatle concerts, and it's just legend at this point. It's one amazing memory, a golden, precious memory of life, kind of. And I gave them bad reviews because I hated all the screaming girls. And I still don't. There's another thing I don't understand. Why were those girls screaming? What does that have to do with being in love with someone? Screaming.
You don't scream at people you love.
Well, you do. You always scream at the ones you love.
You don't just see them. They walk in a room and then you just go into like a panicked screaming fit to where you fall on the ground.
If you really want to be true to love, it should have been just screaming at them in rage. What are you doing? Get off that stage.
Yeah. And it's also so funny. It's like when you see the footage of the Beatles playing these baseball stadiums and that it was a stage just out by like second base and this just smallish. Like now you see, now people's concerts take over the entire stadium would be, you'd know where you would feel the magnitude of the band. But then it was just like, where should we put this stage? I don't know, like second base.
Yeah, no, it was that. But the screaming, you couldn't hear anything. And the first one I went to when I was about 13 or 14, and I was really deeply in love with the Beatles at that point. So I went and the screaming girls, which were all of them, rushed the stage. So they were all around the stage. So the front row was open. So we went to the front row and we were standing on the seats in the front row, couldn't see and couldn't hear anything. That was my experience seeing the Beatles. How great of an experience is that?
You know, those are the details you're supposed to
tell you about the Ken Kesey acid test, right?
Yeah.
I don't really know what. Here's my favorite thing about the Ken Kesey acid test. On my way out, Well, staying there was, it was a weird, you know, I didn't take acid or anything. I just, it was just a big happening, and I was just there waiting to find a way to get my friends to leave with me. And, somebody stuck their hand up my dress, and it was so much smoke, I couldn't close my eyes. And I really wasn't having that great a time, even though the Grateful Dead were playing and everybody was playing and so forth. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we left. When I finally got someone to leave with me, on my way out, I took a poster off the wall of the outside of the building, which was at Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco. And because I had that much space left in my bedroom, and I needed a poster, so I took it with me. And I, like I did with everything that I was telling you, I saved it. And about a year ago, or maybe 6 months, yeah, about a year ago, CNN came to my house, and they did a. I was part of a documentary called "The History of Comedy," and so I had to decorate my office in order to. Be a talking head in this thing. So behind me, among the different things I've put up on the wall, I found this acid test poster. So I hung it up behind me thinking, well, this would be kind of interesting looking.
Mm-hmm.
And almost immediately I started hearing from a certain kind of person who was saying, is that an acid test poster behind you? No one ever mentioned anything I said in the interview. It was just like, is that a blue acid test poster behind you? And the end of the story is that I sold it for $20,000.
Oh my goodness!
Isn't that a great story?
That is maybe the best story.
Yeah, I took it off the wall of a building, and and my mother, of course, wanted me to throw it away because she thought it was disgusting. And then I sold it for $20,000.
$20,000, and now you've been actually going through your archives and the things you've been saving over the years and putting things on eBay.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of auctions. I'm funding all my favorite animal charities, because when I write, I like to give money to charities, but I never can write very big checks because I'm not in that wealth category.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly I realized I had all this stuff from my years at the Letterman Show, like 9 jackets, which are big jackets, by the way. They're all men's large. They have those big leather sleeves, and they're huge. And then I had all this other stuff that, like a couple of baseball shirts and football shirts and all that kind of stuff. And there's a lot of people who like that sort of stuff. So I've been auctioning it off for fairly big ticket, money, and giving the money to charity 100%.
That is awesome. What's coming up? Is there, you have another one coming up?
I have three up right now. The weirdest one, the ones that I think I can never tell which ones are going to appeal to people. I guess people like the jackets a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Last week I sold 3 pieces. I used to do all the remotes for the show the years I was there. I mean, where we took the camera out, I wrote and produced all of those.
Okay. So,
I had a bunch of stuff I saved on a remote. I would find the premises for my remotes by reading the phone book, because that's what we had before the internet, was the Manhattan phone book. So I'd go through it A to Z and look for anything that caught my eye that seemed like there was a question I could ask or something I'd never seen on TV. And I had a wide berth of ideas about what you might want to see on TV that you'd never see on TV. Like, I remember trying to do a piece about aluminum anodizing just because I'd never seen that on TV.
Uh-huh.
And so I did a piece. I had accumulated a bunch of different ads that said, while you wait, while you wait, while you wait, while you wait. And then we went to all of them, and we had something made at each of them while we waited. And then we made a piece out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had those pieces in the closet. We made a joke out of it, and the pieces were crazy. They were about Connie Henderson, stewardess of the year, etc. But I had these things sitting in the closet here, and I sold them last week for $1,000.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And I gave the money to an elephant rescue in Nairobi, which really, really made me happy.
That is so awesome. So people should check those out if they're in the market for Late Night with David Letterman collectibles that you're doing, and it goes to a good cause.
If you look at any of my social media, I keep pushing it on the social media. I keep saying, hey, did you forget about this? But right now there's a thing nobody has bid on that would be a thing I thought somebody would bid on. on the day, on the morning show, the Letterman morning show, we used to have a fake product called Winkie's Cow Paste. And I had quite a bit of Winkie's Cow Paste here, so I was trying to move it on, as an auction item.
Well, that's sitting out there. It's a buyer's market right now for that one. So wait, you really...
It's the only auction offering Winkie's Cow Paste.
Sure.
Anywhere.
And you really... You said you don't have the big money. You burned through all of that new Laugh-In money?
That was what it was. That was when I joined the Writers Guild. I advanced to Writers Guild scale at the Laugh-In. Which for me, I had been an art teacher right before that. So that for me was riches beyond my wildest dreams relative to being an art teacher, getting Writers Guild scale.
Yeah, it really is. It's exciting to get through that door, and you got through it, and you've stayed through it, and you're a legend. Own your legendary status, Merrill Marco.
What was your first job in this?
It would be Monk would be the first
Monk. Right?
Yeah, it was. I could not believe it, and I still can't believe it sometimes.
Yeah. Just to be near Andy Breckman is a dream for most people.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are no... Oh, God, sorry.
I've ever met.
Say that again?
He is one of the funniest people I've ever
met. Oh, my God. No, there's nobody... When he does the thing he can do, it's just truly... You cannot... He could overtake any room... No matter who it is, he could become the funniest person in the room.
And it's very distinct too. It's really, there's just a particular, I can't recreate it for you right now, but it's totally Breckmania.
Oh yeah.
Unlike, it's just his own weird take on everything, and it's consistent.
Oh, it's unbelievable. He really, I'm so glad we both have him in common. I gotta wrap up. I do want to say, one thing that you're known for is your love of dogs, right?
I am known for my love of dogs. Yeah.
Now, what goes into a good dog name? Because sometimes I hear people with dumb dog names.
I have a philosophy, as I do of most things, willing to bore people with. I differ from my beloved with whom I have lived for 20 years. He likes to go for sort of adorable, weird names. And I have always picked, and if left to my own devices, I would return only to this path, human names that nobody would ever imagine would be on a dog.
Okay.
It doesn't sound cute, or it doesn't sound at all like a pet name. Like I thought the other day, Richard.
Richard. Oh, so you'd be in a park and you'd be like, Richard.
Yeah.
Richard. Because you have to picture that when you think about a dog name, you have to picture the yelling of it.
Uh-huh.
Where, because if somebody goes and they name their dog like, if you named your dog like Toilet, then you have to go, God forbid your dog gets loose and you're going through the neighborhood screaming, Toilet! Toilet!
I had a friend who named their dog Taxi.
Mm-hmm. So, that's great. Yeah. Taxi. Yeah.
But I would still over and over again, I dwell on making a list of human names that don't feel like they belong anywhere near a dog. Like
Clark. Clark would not work for a dog, right?
Clark would be a good dog name, I would think.
Okay.
Nice in one syllable. You know, like Richard is annoyingly two syllables, so it becomes really, really unlike a dog.
Gene would not be a good one.
Gene. Yeah, Gene is a good dog name.
You
Gene.
Think so?
I think there are people who name their dogs Tom, right? Nobody would name their dog Merrill. So that's
that, sounds, that sounds like a challenge. Sounds like you just put a challenge out. On,
I'll name all my dogs Merrill from now on.
Yeah. Well, Merrill, Marco, I want to say your book is great. It's called We Saw Scenery, and it's your early diaries from your childhood, and you did the illustrations for them too. Yeah, is that you? You did the illustrations. That's What can't you do? Let's just list what you can't do. It would be a shorter list, apparently.
I literally can do everything. It's really surprising.
It's very impressive. And the book, in all seriousness, is such a funny book, and it's sweet. And I think people are going to really like it. If they should check it out. And
a good Christmas present.
There you go. Yes. A good Christmas present. We saw Scenery, the early diaries of Meryl Marco, and you.
Thank you.
You are somebody who I was a little lad with a TV in my own bedroom when I shouldn't have had one, and I just watched television round the clock, and I watched that very first episode of Late Night. When it happened, and it was because I watched the summer show. I did watch the summer show.
You mean the morning show?
Yeah. The one because it was on in the summer, right? Was it?
Right.
The morning show? Yes. I remember watching that, and I was excited about the late night show, and I watched that first episode, and it changed everything for me. And so you are a part of changing everything for me. So I thank you for that.
That's great. I'm glad that I was able to facilitate that.
Well, I appreciate all of it, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
All right. Well, this has been lovely. And as you were, as they say.
As you were. Yes, as you were. Thank you. Thanks so much, Meryl. I'll talk to you soon. Okay. Bye. That was nice.
The Best Show is produced in partnership with the Forever Dog Podcast Network. The show is hosted by Tom Sharpling and features John Worster, Jason Gore, Pat Byrne, and Michael Lisk. The show is produced and written by Jason Gore, Pat Byrne, Michael Lisk, John Worster, and Tom Sharpling. The Best Show is executive produced by Tom Sharpling, Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. The show is engineered and mastered by Andrew Gleason. Website and technical support provided by Martine Sellis, and the show is recorded at Forever Dog Studios in Los Angeles. Support The Best Show on Patreon over at patreon.com/thebestshow and follow us on YouTube, Twitter, and Instagram over at Best Show for Life. That's Best Show number 4 Life. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.